Let me start with asking you what you see your role as covering national security issues and if that's changed in the, correct me if I'm wrong, decades of covering this issue.
It has changed. Fortunately, we have a big team of people who cover national security. So our role is the following. It's to explain to the American people the way national security policy is made in the United States, how effective it has been, what happens when those systems go awry, and to talk about, even though it frequently leaves the government unhappy, programs that can have an enormous effect on the lives of ordinary Americans that the U.S. government does not want to discuss. Why are those important to do, particularly when they're classified programs? Because everything the United States does around the world not only affects the image of the country, but comes back and redounds on us in different ways. So President Obama, when asked to go reauthorize parts of the Stuxnet cyber program that President Bush had started, asked a very good question. If we do this, are we going to begin to see countries around the world attacking the U.S.? Well, we went ahead and did it, and we have seen a huge increase in the number of state-sponsored cyber attacks on the U.S.
You are dealing with a subject that, as we saw during the talk today, gets deflected a lot in the interest of everyone's security. We just can't tell you because then it'll ruin all of our safety. Do you buy that?
Look, there are some things about which there are legitimate secrets. Most of them have to do with a specific technique or a capability that an adversary may not know, or the timing of an operation that would give an adversary a big leg up. But by and large, I believe there is wild overclassification in the U.S. government. That's particularly true in the area of cyber because it's one of the first weapons ever to have been developed by the intelligence community, not by more traditional means. And as a result, you've got a community of developers who are accustomed to keeping everything secret. And my own view is that if we're going to develop rules about how and when we use cyber weapons around the world, we're going to need to do what we did in nuclear and in drones and in other areas, which is try to keep the workings of how you make an atomic bomb or how you make a drone stealthy, keep that secret, but have a very open debate about the fact that we have the capability and how do we want to go use it. And, you know, when you think back to the nuclear age, we had that debate after Hiroshima, all the way through to the 1970s. And while the details of how to make an atomic weapon were kept secret, we had huge arguments about whether the United States should drop bombs on the North Koreans and the Chinese during the Korean War, whether we should have bombed the Russians during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was advocated by some Air Force generals. And in the end, we ended up with a policy on our nuclear weapons that was completely the opposite of where we started. We decided we would only use them to preserve the nation state as a very last resort, that we would not build them into our military strategy other than as a deterrent. We haven't had that debate in the newest area, which is cyber.
The talk that you just moderated, the title was No Room for Error. If we do make an error, what's the consequence?
Like everything in life, there are big errors and there are little errors. 9/11 was a huge error. And we lost 3,000 lives. And it was a terrible, terrible day. I was White House correspondent at that time for the Times, and I was with President Bush down in Florida as that unfolded. And was as far away from him as I am from you right now, and you could see a presidency change in front of your eyes, and you saw a decade and a half of American policy change, because suddenly everything we did in the world was refocused on the concept of counterterrorism. I don't think we have that luxury anymore. not only, as Tom Bossert, the President's Homeland Security Advisor, said here at Aspen, have we been tactically successful but not strategically that successful in counterterrorism, we left a lot of areas for American leadership on the side of the road. And we changed the way people think about the United States. So I would advocate that we need to understand that we're never going to eradicate all terrorism any more than we're going to eradicate all gun deaths or drug deaths in the United States. It's not an easy thing for a politician to come out and say, my goal is to reduce terrorism to an acceptable level. But the fact of the matter is, we work on reducing slippage in bathtubs to an acceptable level. We work on reducing gang violence to an acceptable level. We work on reducing drug deaths to an acceptable level, because we know that we're never going to wipe all of it out. As long as there are crazy people in the world who are willing to go give their lives for an extremist cause, you're going to have terrorism deaths. But you can manage it. You can learn how to be resilient so that you bounce back from it. And most importantly, you have to learn what requires a big strategic response from the United States and what does not. We spent a lot of lives and trillions of dollars responding to the 9/11 attacks, sometimes in some very good and acceptable ways. I think anybody who had been president would have gone into Afghanistan to go find al-Qaeda and hunt down Osama bin Laden. But somehow we let that take us into Iraq, which was one of our greatest strategic errors in modern times.
Are we safe?
We are safer than we were by far against a 9/11 style attack. But just as generals are always fighting the last war, counterterrorism planners are always fighting the last attack. And that's why you've got to stay ahead of the game. And that's part of the, only can be wrong once. And, you know, you saw that reflected in this desire to suddenly inspect laptop computers, right? Because there were new and devious ways to turn the battery compartments into explosives. The biggest, hardest intellectual change for people to get their heads around is in the cyber arena, I'm convinced. Because people don't fundamentally understand the connective tissue between things that you do on a keyboard and things that go wrong in the real world. So for decades, cyber attacks were computer on computer. I used my computer in code to mess up your computer in code, and maybe sometimes to use it for theft from a bank account and so forth. But what made Stuxnet so different was that it was one of the first times that we had ever used computer code to actually go blow up a country's centrifuges deep underground in the desert in Iraq. And then came along the Sony attack, in which the North Koreans, who can, barely make a light bulb, managed to melt down 70% of Sony Pictures Entertainment's computer systems. People don't remember that. They remember the released emails that said Angelina Jolie was a pain to work with for some producers, as if, we care, right? But what was significant here was it was a physical attack. And then you saw the Russian attack, which was not on physical systems that we run, but was on the underpinning of the American democracy. So cyber is the arena where we have the highest chance of being thrown off by an absence of imagination.
We're 6 months into this new presidency that's been quite a theater. Are there flashy things that we're paying too much attention to and other things that are slipping by?
Well, we're trying really hard, not always successfully, to stay focused on the question of what is this president doing that's new and different in a policy way. Some of them have been obvious, leaving the Paris Accords on climate change, canceling TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, biggest Pacific trade deal. But in other ways where he's actually needed to put together a something of a legislative majority, starting with health care, it's been a complete train wreck. Because this is a White House that is strong about what it believes, but a president who doesn't want to delve very much into the details. And you kept getting the sense through the healthcare debate that he cared about winning, which is to say getting rid of Obamacare and creating something new, than what the content of it was. And then you'd get these annoying reports from the Congressional Budget Office that would say, well, actually 32 million people or 25 million people or 20 million people would lose coverage by some date 8 or 10 years in the future. And those numbers may be right and they may be wrong, but they certainly undercut the central question, which was, what are we trying to do here, which was come up with better health care. So the theater of covering this president, and there's a lot of theater and a lot of emotion and a lot of leaked emails and a lot of pronouncements and certainly a lot of tweets, you got to cover that.
Okay.
But you never want to lose sight of the fundamental question of what's actually changing.
We have a fascinating cast of characters here for the Security Forum, directors of CIA, defense, national security. Is there one person you have your eye on who you think will have the most influence on our future security policies?
That's a really interesting question. Well, I'm just thinking, I mean, the Security Forum and the Institute in general are remarkable, particularly in these beautiful days of summer, in their ability to draw out so many fascinating people. Tom Bossert, who I just interviewed in that public interview before, holds a really critical job. He and H.R. McMaster, who's the National Security Advisor. You're going to hear later in the day from Mike Pompeo, who was in Congress for a long time. Really smart, interesting guy who's running the CIA, but has a very different approach to the CIA than his predecessor, John Brennan. So I'll be very interested to hear from him as well.
Okay. What answers are you seeking? They're back at the office. What's on the whiteboard right now?
You know, my biggest fear as somebody who reports in this area, but who also teaches national security strategy, is the question, what are we missing? What are we not thinking about? What's not in the headline now, but around the corner, that we should be covering and writing about? And just think, after 9/11, we all asked ourselves the question, what should we have understood about why they hate us? What should we have understood about radical Islamic movements? What do we need to understand about the dysfunction of the Middle East? And we weren't asking the right questions on it. After the Arab Spring happened, we all asked ourselves, why did we not see this coming? Well, some people did see it coming, including, I would have to say, President Obama, who had ordered up a number of interesting studies because he thought we were dealing with fundamentally unstable regimes. In cyber, we've been surprised and surprised and surprised again. A year ago at this forum, if you asked people what was the number one cyber threat, they would have said, you know, a massive attack that hits the power grid and turns out all the lights from Boston to Washington. Today, they're going to tell you it's rigging elections. We're only 12 months difference. What changes that perception? An inability to sort of imagine where this technology is going.
Are you confident that some of your sources know where it's going?
No, but I'm not confident that's necessarily possible. It's just, I always ask myself the question, what could we be missing that we're just not even discussing? Which is a different question than, what's the change going to be in detention policy, or what's the change going to be in counterterrorism policy, or something like that.
David, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Always great to be back here in Aspen.
David Sanger is the chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. I'm Allison Bechtesh. You're listening to Morning Edition on Aspen Public Radio.